Hey there, welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for being here. William Jackson Harper plays the hilariously tortured philosophy professor Chidi Aganonye on the smart NBC comedy The Good Place. So while the network show enjoyed great reviews as it entered its fall season a couple weeks ago, Harper was working on another project, this time behind the scenes. He's written a play called Travisville about a Texas church community and its reckoning with the civil rights movement. Travisville has its world premiere this past Friday at the Ensemble Studio Theater in New York City, where it's running until October 28th. We're thrilled to have Will Harper in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
So Travisville, where is Travisville? And what's going on in Travisville that's causing so much tension?
Well, there is a planned development that will displace a significant number of people in the African American community, and yeah, that's basically what's happening. It's not a real city. But Travisville is the name of the project and of the development that will sort of raise all these houses and displace all these people.
And it's about 1964?
64, yeah.
And Travis, you're from Texas, right?
Yeah.
Travis is a big name in Texas.
Yeah,
so that
is. Kind
of, because he was, at the Alamo, right?
Yeah, William B. Travis, yeah.
So is that why you named it Travisville?
Yeah.
Just like kind of as an identification for Texas?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where I feel like a lot of names in Texas sort of harken back to heroes of the Alamo, so I tried to throw a few of those names in there just to sort of like place it in Texas, since I didn't place it in a specific city.
Now, the main characters in the play are these different religious leaders, mm-hmm. and they've formed this Ministers Alliance. And you really explore the dual role of the religious leader, especially in that time, mm-hmm. as leader and politician. Can you talk a little bit about the balance of how these leaders were both?
Well, I feel like one can always depend on one's pastor to give all kinds of advice on whatever's going on, you know, in your life. And I think that in particular in this time, social issues were just very much at the front of everyone's mind. And I think that it just sort of became incumbent upon ministers to address them in some way, seeing as how it was affecting people's happiness and their ability to sort of lead the life that they should be leading as a religious person. So I think that sort of dictates that role or makes that role necessary for the minister.
And also, these ministers in the play are different generations.
Yeah.
And they're coming at this idea of civil rights and obtaining your rights from different points of view. Tell us a little bit about the three different ministers that are the focus of the play.
Okay. Well, first off, we have Reverend Nora Fletcher, who is sort of next in line to head the Ministers Alliance. He is younger, actually, well, not younger, but he's around, like, in my head, around my age, sort of like late 30s. And he is, he's very smart. He has a progressive bent to his politics. However, he's very thoughtful, and he's not sure if his impulses are necessarily going to lead to any sort of positive change. We have Elder Alden Hurst, who is his mentor, who he will be taking over for in the Ministers Alliance, who is a far more sort of slow-moving, conservative, go-along-to-get-along type, who has made his name by sort of shielding the black community in this town from any kind of violence by making concessions. And there's also Daryl Gunn, who is a minister who has a past, and he finds himself in this city sort of advocating for more progressive policies, but not 100% sure that he's right either, but just more willing to sort of push for these things than the other ministers on the Alliance.
And they bring in, there's an outside agitator who comes in, not an agitator in that he mixes things up. He changes the alchemy of the situation because he is someone's fighting for civil rights on the national level who comes down into this town and wants to use, I don't mean that in the pejorative, but wants this to be a case where they can enact change on a local level, but from a national perspective. Who is he? His name is Zeke Phillips.
And he's a young man, 23, really smart, but doesn't know the inner workings of this community. And yes, you're right. He is looking at this from a national perspective. But I think he really does want to ensure that these people are able to keep their home, keep their homes, or are given a fair enough offer so they have some sort of agency in where they go next. And that's what he's fighting for.
There's also just this interesting dynamic between, and it's a very subtle line that you wrote about, they ask him where he's from, and he's went, I went to Morehouse, and I'm from Atlanta. So there's this other layer of class and education of him coming into this tiny Texas town with some folks who maybe aren't as educated and telling them what to do. Why did you want to sort of introduce that layer?
Well, because I feel like, I mean, Morehouse has a legacy of very, very smart civil rights icons that went there. And I just felt like it just tracked to me that a really smart young man would come out of that school. You know, there is just a naivete to energy and vigor to being 23 years old and having a very clear perspective on the world that hasn't been muddied by family or by, you know, a committed spouse yet, you know, and some people may have those things at that age, but he does not. And so I wanted someone that was just not of that place and not of that, almost not of that time to come in and sort of like really push things in a direction that he wants and to try to make the world honestly more in his image than theirs.
We're talking to Will Harper about his new play Travisville. You said something very interesting in an interview. Said that you wanted to take on a narrative that challenges the civil rights story we typically see, where there are evil white people and good black people, and the black people overcome, and nothing is ever wrong again in America. What do you mean by that?
Well, I feel like there's like this sort of weird sepia-toned hope that like sort of pervades these stories, and I just don't buy it. I feel like the world that we live in now is really complicated, and I feel like a lot of the ideas that I was told as a kid and as a young man that are, you know, no longer part of our cultural zeitgeist, they seem to be coming back. And I wanted to write a story that sort of feels like the ancestor to the world that we have, as opposed to the ancestor to the world that I think we wish we had. And so I wanted to be sort of complicated and unresolved and honestly maybe a little bit angry, because I feel like that's something that I need, you know, just to sort of make sense of where we're at.
When you were a kid in Dallas, there was a book called The Accommodation.
Yeah.
Tell me about this book and how it plays into your writing of this play.
Well, there was this author, Jim Schutz, wrote this book called The Accommodation, and it was about racial politics in Dallas, running from like the early 50s all the way up until the 70s. And there's a lot of things actually in Travisville that are very much, very much inspired by that book. One is the ministers that were willing to make concessions to white civic leaders and business leaders, in order to, you know, keep the sort of tumult of the civil rights movement from really overtaking the city of Dallas, there is also an energy of trying to to have a sort of a kind of progressivism that was only in that town. That was the hope, I guess, and that was the idea. And so, that was sort of like a lot of the ministers' voices inspired a lot of the ministers' voices in my play. And actually, the fight for the neighborhood of the Fanning Gardens neighborhood in the play is inspired by an attempt from City Hall in Dallas to actually build a parking lot in a predominantly Black neighborhood. And there was a young man who happened to be in town who helped these residents fight it, and they actually won.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's that sort of marked a shift. So I was like, this is so interesting. I had no idea that, you know, this sort of things happened in the city that I grew up in.
As you were writing about this, that's another part of this play, is this idea of these neighborhoods and people being pretty much cheated out of their homes so that there could be commerce, there could be a shopping mall built where these houses were. And the idea that if these houses are named as being part of urban blight, eminent domain can come in and take over the neighborhoods.
Right.
As you were researching this, did you concentrate just on Southern neighborhoods or just on Dallas, or did you go bigger?
I really kept it pretty vague as far as the eminent domain mm-hmm. questions, because it's like such a rabbit hole. And it gets very, very nuanced. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to get bogged down by the question of, you know, what is eminent domain? I really wanted to sort of unpack I wanted to sort of deconstruct the idea of this monolithic view of the civil rights movement and Black opinion and thought of the time. When it came right down to it, it's like I just realized that, you know, eminent domain can be just about building a road mm-hmm. or building a parking lot, something that is for the public good. But there also are examples where houses are raised and a building is put up, and it's not necessarily there. It's like the public-private partnership is something that's sort of dicey, and it's like, why were all these people removed?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, well, I think I can say what I'm saying in this play.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the extent of it, because I didn't want to like make it just about eminent domain. I really wanted to make it about the people.
That's such an interesting choice you had to make as a writer. Like, which way you're going to go? Are you going to do the urban removal, or are you going to talk about the fights within the civil rights movement?
Right, right. And I think the play is pretty full as it is. And so I didn't want to, you know, to really go into everything just about eminent domain seemed like it would just take me way off track.
That's your next play.
Yeah.
When I went to see the play, they mentioned that you'd been working on it for 8 years.
Yeah.
8 years ago?
Yeah.
Well, what were you doing during that time? Were the rewrites? Did you put it away? Did you go concentrate on your acting career? Did you come back?
I started writing the play actually at a retreat for Ensemble Studio Theater. I was working as an actor on another piece. And at this retreat, you know, a lot of writers would go, and they would go to these workshops and stuff, and we as actors could go every now and again. So I went, and I had this idea sort of kicking around. But I didn't really know what to do with it, and so like these workshops sort of like set me on the right path. So wrote it. We did actually the next year we did a workshop of my play at this same sort of retreat, and then we just sort of sat on it for about 3 years. Another piece sort of took up a lot of space and was getting a lot of the resources at the time, and rightfully so. And so it was just a long gap, and then we would revisit it for a year, and then another long gap. And, you know, it's just mm-hmm. sort of like this, just the process of it, getting notes.
Does it feel like it's though the right time? Like maybe there were supposed to be the gap, so it came out this year?
Maybe, I guess so. I mean, like I felt like I was writing in response to a lot of things, even at the time when I wrote the first draft, but now it feels more appropriate. So yeah, I think it all worked out.
As an actor, how did your work as an actor inform your work as a playwright?
You know, I want everyone to have a reason to be there. And I want all the actors to have something to do, you know, at least one moment where they are, where their point of view and what they want in the play becomes very clear on stage and in front of all of us as the audience. And so I think that it sort of lent itself, I think, in this play to every actor on stage having a moment that they really get to fight for their point of view. I'd like to think that the dialogue is fun to listen to. You know, a lot. I can't thank this cast enough for leaning so hard into it and just going for it with mm-hmm. everything that they had. But I feel like these are the things that I really cling to as I'm writing.
Do you know the members of the cast? You've worked with these folks before?
I have. A lot of them I've worked with before, yeah. Brian D. Coates, who played Elder Hurst, he's actually done...
He's great.
Yeah. He's one of the best actors I've seen in my life. And he's been with the play ever since its first reading. And actually, when we first cast it, we was like, well, you know, he's a little young for the part.
8 years ago.
8 years ago, he was a little young, and, you know, and but I mean, he's just such a powerhouse that, you know, it was just like, well, no, I think this works.
It was interesting. We're talking to Will Harper about his play Travisville, which is playing at the Ensemble Studio Theater through October 28th. You got a real rave review. I think it was the Daily Beast, and said, I could really see this on Broadway, which is a lovely thing to read about your play.
Yeah.
But in Ensemble Theater, it's intimate. You're feeling very much as if you're sort of in the room with these characters. Do you think it could play in a bigger house? And what would the direction need to be like if that happened?
I really don't know. I think in my head, I sort of always conceived it for EST, for Ensemble Studio Theater, mm-hmm. Because I want it to feel very close. And I like the fact that people don't have to project so much. You know, I feel like you just feel like you're in the room. Look, if there's a way to do it in a Broadway house, I'm totally open to it. But, you know, I really sort of like the intimacy of it.
Do you have any other plays you're working on?
I have a lot of things on my desktop, but it's all trash. It's all a lot of things that I haven't...
Everything starts as trash.
Though. Yeah.
The first draft never sees the light of day.
No, I just like get halfway through something and just start sweating. I'm like, why am I doing this? And I leave and I just let it go. So, you know, there's a lot of things sitting there. And maybe one of them will turn into something, but right now it's all just straight garbage.
For acting, what's next?
For acting, actually, I just finished shooting a movie in Budapest.
Cool.
Called Midsommar, and it's a horror movie by writer director Ari Aster, who did Hereditary.
Oh, that's scary.
So yeah, that just wrapped up, and so now I'm just hanging out and watching the play a lot and watching this incredible cast do incredible work.
And I have to say, The Good Place is one of my favorite shows. It's just so smart and snarky and on point. What do you like about working on that show? I don't want to give too much away, because if people haven't watched it, you got to watch it all the way through. But what do you like about that show as an actor?
I like that you call it snarky, because I feel like it's snarky too.
It's very snarky.
I think the thing that I like the most is there is a very clear response politically to what's happening in a lot of the scripts. And I think that some people are just, you know, they're able to digest it because of the skill of our writer's room and of, you know, our creator, Mike Schur. So I'm just so excited to be a part of something that I think people are really open to, that has a point of view.
And for those who don't know the premise, it's about four people who go to the good place, meaning heaven, and how they're dealing with that. And one of the things I think this show actually doesn't get enough credit for is the diversity of the cast.
Yeah.
Because there's everybody, all types, and it doesn't hit you over the head that now we have an Indian woman and an Asian man.
Right.
And blah. It's very interesting, and I'm surprised it hasn't hit more on that level with people, critics anyway.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I don't know why. It's so funny, because I think, you know, my upbringing in Texas and my upbringing, or well, my living in New York, my world has always kind of looked like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's when the world is homogenous in any direction, you know, I'm always just sort of I'm more likely to clock that mm-hmm. than a world that is very multicultural. And so I didn't really quite clock how diverse our cast was until, like, you know, people brought it up. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess this is really uncommon on TV to see this much unforced diversity.
It's really fun to watch that show.
Thanks.
Will Harper, thank you for coming to All of It. Really appreciate it. Will's new play, Travisville, is running now at the Ensemble Studio Theater on 52nd Street. And, of course, The Good Place airs weekly on NBC. Come up next, author Barbara Kingsolver, perhaps best known for The Poisoned Bible, has a new novel that's both historic and timely. All of It will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Our next guest is a best-selling author whose blockbuster novel, The Poisonwood Bible, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. That was about 20 years ago, and Barbara Kingsolver has remained a prolific and timely writer. Her newest novel, which comes out tomorrow, is called Unsheltered. The book follows two narratives that unfold under the same roof. One took place in the 1860s, and the other storyline takes place during the 2016 election. Both narratives focus on families stuck in protracted cases of precarity and fighting for progressive ideals in a divided world with a new set of rules that no one seems to completely understand. We're thrilled to have Barbara Kingsolver in studio today. Nice to see you. Welcome to All of It.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So, deciding to tell two different stories under one roof, what was the genesis of that?
Well, I wanted to write about this moment we seem to be in, which kind of feels like the end of the world as we know it. So many of the things that we've always counted on, so many different kinds of shelter, are failing us, whether it's just the fact that the hope or the trust that there will be a job at the end of the college degree or a pension at the end of the career or good health care, or even that the ice on the poles will stay frozen or that there will always be more fish in the sea. The rules of civility, the rules of sort of what makes good government, what makes a patriot, all seem to be just gone, just like over. So what are the new rules? We seem to be in a time when everything we've counted on is failing us. And I thought, well, it's impossible to understand a crisis when you're in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. So what if I looked back in history at another moment when people really felt like the world was ending. All the things they believed in were suddenly proving false. What if I took those characters and a set of characters in modern times and put them in the same house and, of course, made the house fall down around them? Would that be interesting? I thought it would learn something from that, and I thought that I could ask questions that would be relevant to the reader and to the moment.
Now, the book takes place, the modern part, during the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. When did you actually start writing that part?
Well, around sort of 2014, 15, 16, I was really plotting out the architecture of the novel in 2014, 15, and began telling the story month to month in real time, really, during the primary season.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was. And there was this very strange new kind of leadership or patriotism or sort of nationalist pull that I was seeing on the horizon. And I thought, well, that's scary and fascinating and absolutely germane to the novel. Because really what a novelist... what we write about is human behavior. And I'm really interested in this novel in examining what people do when they feel like the world is ending. When we're afraid, when we're losing safety, what do we hang on to? And it seems that people can go two very different ways. They can either sort of try to look past what's falling down around them, to stand out, to step outside and look at the sky and see what's new, or they can hold on desperately to what used to be. And so I saw this really playing out in almost a melodrama around me in the political news of the day to day. It was really almost like a morality play. People were behaving so classically along mm-hmm. these extremes. So I just kept writing, and I thought, well, probably by the time this novel is released, some of this crazy stuff will be just over and nobody will remember it.
So you thought this was all going to be resolved.
maybe bad for the world, but good for the novel. It's all still relevant.
Well, the main characters in the modern portion of the novel, the part that takes place in the 2016 election, it's a couple, this woman named Willa. She used to work at a magazine. It's very funny when she's asked about it. Somebody says, oh, one of those glossy? She's like, yeah, and it folded.
Yeah.
And her husband has been chasing the tenure track. And there's this great line. They think they've done everything right. Uh-huh. They kind of have done everything right. And in the book you write, the fact that taking all the right turns has led her family to the wrong place, moneyless and a few storms away from homelessness.
Yep, that's right.
So Will is in this position. What did you want readers to take away from Willa's position and Willa's disposition towards her position?
Well, they could take whatever they please, but I chose to write about people who had identified themselves as middle class for most of their lives. And that was not an accident. I often write about people, I write about poverty pretty often. Mm-hmm. I live in Southern Appalachia, and I live in a world where there are, you know, a lot of kinds of people living different kinds of lives, but class is really clear. And I write about that. But in this case, it seemed that something new is afoot when even people who have really had expectations of comfort and who've always lived with the expectation that they would have something to pass on to their kids, even that level of shelter is failing. And I have found in the process of talking with a lot of interviewers who happen to be perhaps middle-aged women working for magazines that are on the edge of folding. Mm-hmm. I found a lot of sympathy. These are, and her husband, Yano, he's worked so hard. He finally had tenure and his college closed. This has happened too.
And their son has tremendous debt from going to a fine university.
Exactly. He has enormous college debts, which are unpayable. And the aged parent who lives with them, who has every kind of health care problem in the world, can't get decent health care. So these are all problems that people I know are dealing with, even people who had expected a level of comfort. And into this mix is the daughter, the younger daughter, Tig, who's just the maverick and the thorn in everybody's side, who's saying, well, what did you expect? You know, when you're all banking on this system that depends on infinite growth, well, where do you think you live? What's infinite? You know, when you use up everything a planet can give you, then what? So that becomes the question that nobody really wants to answer. Which is the question nobody really wants to answer. And to throw that into relief, we go back and forth in this novel to the earlier century when people are just beginning to learn or to be told that humans are subject to natural law, not the other way around, because Darwin has just published these two books that kind of rocked everybody's world in a bad way. Nobody wanted to hear that people are not in charge of the world. The world is in charge of us.
We're speaking with Barbara Kingsolver about her new novel, Unsheltered. So let's talk about that part of the book, because it's fascinating on a couple of levels. One, that you use historical figures.
Yeah.
People sent me to the internet to find out who Mary Treat was. Let's start first, though. It's set in Vineland, New Jersey.
Right.
Which is in our neighborhood here of WNYC. Mm-hmm. Explain to people about the founding of Vineland and what was special about it.
Vineland, New Jersey was founded as a utopian community by this guy, Charles Landis, who bought a bunch of, he bought 30,000 acres of wilderness and laid out streets, brought in the railroad, and he said, this is going to be a perfect community. His idea was the Victorian ideal of a perfect society. He would bring in immigrants from other countries who were good farmers to do all the work, and then he would attract intellectuals and philosophers, and he would have these great lecture series, and somehow or other his idea of a perfect world included this class structure where there are the workers who are doing all the hard stuff and the wealthy people who are benefiting from their labor. And it was invisible, just as I earlier said, that you can't see what's wrong with your deal when you're in the middle of it. He saw nothing wrong with this. Most of the people there, including the farmers who were going bankrupt, didn't get why they were so unhappy, because it was supposed to be perfect. I didn't originally, and this was a real place, Vineland, founded by Charles Landis so self-consciously that one of the first buildings that he built in the town was a historical society, where he began
There's no history of the place.
Where he began depositing his newspaper, which he wrote and edited from the very first edition. So it's all there. So 150 years of history of this place are preserved there. It was a lucky strike that I found this town. I knew from the beginning that I wanted to set up this double story, these two sets of characters in two centuries that would tell one story. And I knew that the earlier characters would be somehow involved in the Darwin debate/debacle. I needed somebody, an American scientist, who had a stake in that debate. I thought maybe a high school science teacher who wanted to teach Darwin, who would get in big trouble with his principal and his the town fathers and all of that. I wanted to find a real person, a historical figure, who would be an important part of the novel. And I initially thought it might be Darwin. I really love him, and someday I'll write about Darwin, but it needed to be set in the US. So this novel was a novel looking for a setting for several years. I read a lot about Asa Gray, who was a champion of Darwin, but he just didn't do it for me somehow. Sorry, Asa. Tinder swipe left, I guess. I probably got that wrong. Then I just ran across the name Mary Treat, who was a lady scientist, as they called him then, who had corresponded with Asa Gray, with Darwin, with all the other important men of science of the time, and I could find out very little about her. Nobody's written about her, except that she lived in Vineland. So I called the historical society there to see if they had information, and they said, oh, yes, come and see what we've got. They had a gold mine. Mary Treat lived in Vineland. She died without heirs, without children, so all of her papers are there. So I found this woman who left not only a body of beautiful writing, important writing, and experimental work that she did with Darwin, but also a really amazing life. She had a crazy husband who ran off to New York chasing a suffragette, and I discovered this town, which I hadn't known about, Vineland, with this this petty dictator, Charles Landis, who with his ruddy cheeks and odd flop of hair, who reminded me of somebody else that I was noticing in the news. And
the universe was speaking to you.
The universe was speaking to me. So Mary Treat was the lightning rod. She just riveted me to Vineland. And so I spent time there researching both the Victorian Vineland and the modern Vineland, and that became a really important part of the story. What does utopia turn into in 100? Give utopia 150 years and see what happens.
And there's one other woman character I want to ask about, Yuri Carruth.
Yuri Carruth. He's a newspaper editor.
That's right.
He is Yuri Carruth, who is a son of Russian immigrants who came to Vineland, started a newspaper, the opposition newspaper, because in this perfect utopian town, as Charles Landis envisioned it, there's only one newspaper. It's Landis's newspaper. It gives his version of the story, which is that everybody's happy, land of milk and honey, no problems. And meanwhile, all of these farmers are losing everything. So Yuri Carruth comes in to be the spokesperson for the underclass, for the working class. So he starts an opposition newspaper. This is all true. This is all really
happened. That's what's so interesting to me about this whole part of the book is based on fact.
This really happened. So, and not only did he decide to start an opposition newspaper, he put its offices exactly next door to Landis's newspaper. So he's kind of flaunting it. You know, he's the thorn in Landis's side, but he's telling the truth. He's punching a hole in the, you know, in this reality of Landis in publishing his newspaper of, you know, someone might call it fake news, but it was actually what was happening. So, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, but just around the same time I heard, I read in the news about some modern figure boasting that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose any voters. Well, right about then I read that this Charles Landis figure actually did shoot somebody on Main Street, and he got away with it. So it was just all too amazing.
Are you telling me history is cyclical, Barbara?
I'm telling you that people are people. We have these proclivities. When we're nervous, when we're afraid, when we feel like there's not enough to go around, there are ways that we predictably behave, for better and for worse. And it could be that looking back at previous times when we felt this same kind of disorientation in the universe, when we felt these failures of our shelter, and we look at the choices we made, we might make some wiser decisions about where these choices lead.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you a bigger picture question.
Okay.
You established the Penn Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction.
I did.
What is that about and why is that important to you?
I established that prize more than 20 years ago, in 1998, when I received my first, what I would call a big advance for a book. My writing career had reached the point where I earned more than I needed to keep my modest little family happy and fed. I thought I would like to use what's left over to help other writers who have something that they want to write about that has to do with the troubles of the day, current events, real things, real issues that can be addressed in fiction. This is not always the easiest thing for writers to do. It takes some courage. It takes sometimes standing up to opposition, to people who tell you just keep quiet and write about, you know, alcoholics or marriage or something smaller. Not that those are small things, but, you know, to be ambitious in your fiction, to go beyond the small conflict into larger conflicts is scary, and I wanted to reward that kind of courage. And so for 20 years, we've given this prize every other year to a first novelist, an unpublished first novelist, to really help found a career for an artist of courage.
That must be really satisfying.
It's wonderful, and every one of them has turned out to be a remarkable writer and a remarkable human being.
Barbara Kingsolver, thank you so much for being with us on All of It.
You're welcome.
The book on shelter is available on Tuesday, October 16th. Also, Barbara has two events. Greenlight Books hosts Barbara Kingsolver at St. Joseph's College at 245 Clinton at 7:30. That's this evening. And Symphony Space tomorrow. That's at Broadway and 95th. Coming up next on All of It, on November 8th, 2016, we're going to keep talking about this election day. Once the results came in and Hillary Clinton gave her concession speech, where did she go? What was she thinking? A new musical imagines Hillary's inner life after that defeat. We'll talk to its creator. Stay with us. All of It will be back after a break. Thank you for listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Okay, who was surprised by the results of the 2016 presidential election? Well, you probably weren't as shocked as Hillary Clinton. During that first year post-Donald Trump's win, Hillary Clinton was mostly not heard from, and that was frustrating to some of her supporters, one of whom was deeply concerned for her. Singer-songwriter Rebecca Pronsky began thinking about the post-election world from HRC's point of view and started writing an album about the experience. The work is called Hillary Clinton Song Cycle Witness. Let's listen to a first cut called Things Never Change.
I wake up in my big white house. I'm on top. Everything works out. The job is tough, but I'm qualified. I deserve what I got. The world was justified. Oh no, that was just a dream. Don't get excited, honey.
Rebecca Pronsky is currently presenting the show at the New York International Fringe Festival. Welcome to the studio, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Witness was originally released as a concept album a year after the presidential election. Did you start working on it immediately after?
Well, I had a little time where I didn't know what I was going to do with myself as an artist. And I had a really hard time getting back to writing music. I'm a singer-songwriter, mm-hmm. and I've been writing from my own perspective forever. And I just was also simultaneously really concerned about Hillary Clinton and wondering what happened to her, because she disappeared. And I was worried that maybe she, you know, wasn't well. Mm-hmm. So I got kind of concerned about her, and I started writing these songs to make myself feel better and to answer my questions about how she was doing. And I realized I was writing from her perspective instead of mine, and that, you know, all put together would be a great idea for a concept album. So I made the record, and now it's a show.
So when you were starting to write from the point of view of Hillary Clinton, as you felt yourself sort of morphing into that mindset, what were some of the feelings and ideas that you wanted to explore?
Well, I figured that, like all of us, she was probably going through several stages of grief. And so I was also, you know, myself going through a lot of that. So I kind of wrote each song as a stage of grief. That song you just heard is the denial song.
There's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance.
Yeah. And then I realized I had some more things. So I added a couple more stages in between. There's just a song where she just swears a lot and is angry. And there's a song where she just feels like, well, you know what? Since I'm done here, I'm just going to not wear makeup. I'm going to just take off my shoes and watch Netflix and just enjoy myself. And that, when I wrote that, I realized that I felt a lot better just thinking about her having Ben and Jerry's and just relaxing for once.
Now, during the process of writing this, were you actually following her comings and goings, the hikings in the woods?
I was. There's actually a song called Walk in the Woods. But there was so little that we heard from her that most of it I just didn't have a lot to go on and just came up with my own thoughts about what she was up to.
Now, you studied ethnomusicology. So what did you learn about the role of music in storytelling and in creating our histories, especially in this very recent history?
I heard you're also a Brown grad.
I am. I'm just old.
I think I'm probably not much younger. Sure. I mean, I learned a lot about music and its relationship with culture, and how music is a way that people, you know, are able to come together and write their own stories. And then as a singer-songwriter, it was part of the folk scene where a lot of people were writing, you know, things that were introspective and that related to their own experience. So it wasn't a huge leap to then write from the experience of another person.
So let's play a little bit. The finale is really pretty powerful. I want to play a clip where I guess we come to the acceptance points, but I also want to talk about her as a witness to her own life. Let's take a listen.
Giving in is all I gotta do. If I only knew how to. Give in.
What does that mean to you, her witnessing her own history?
Well, I think that in that point in the show, she kind of comes to understand that her job was not necessarily to win, but to lead and to also watch history as it's unfolding. And, you know, she kind of realizes that she is the next in a line of women that are making history and that we're all sort of moving together, but we're making the tide, but we are the tide. Yeah, I don't know. In the song, it's more clear, I think. But the idea of being a witness to your own experience, but also to the experience of people like you and people around you, I think is what comforts her in the end and what makes her decide to move forward and to go forth with a path of kindness and love rather than bitterness.
We're speaking with Rebecca Pronsky about her show, Hillary Clinton's Song Cycle Witness. We said at the beginning it started out as a musical enterprise and then it has become a show. Tell us a little bit about how you went from not having any staging, it being a group of interesting songs, to being a show.
Well, I made the record with an all-female creative team, which was an amazing experience in itself. And when we decided to do a record release show, I got all of the women that were involved in the record, which was a whole band, producer, engineer, and we got on stage and did the show together. And as I was producing the show, I realized that we should put some Hillary Clinton quotes in here and we could really tie this together. And when we did the show, and we did the show as the record release on the anniversary, the 1-year anniversary of the election, it was so powerful on stage that I realized, I think I've written a musical. This is actually something I should do, like, live. And it really makes sense that way.
What has the response been like?
A lot of people cry. And I didn't realize that it would affect people that deeply, but it really has. People have been to the show and they say that they've really experienced a catharsis because they have to relive some of the election, but not in a way that is painful or that they feel alone. And so the show is really about her experience after the election, but there's a piece of it that kind of like brings you back to that time. But I think that people who've seen it don't really feel that it's, you know, been upsetting. It's mostly brings them into a place where they can reassess and look at that all again in a way that's safe and fun. And then like it's very funny and loose, and there is some crying, but there's also some swearing. And everyone kind of leaves feeling like they had an experience that was fun and light as well as, you know, deep.
Do you know if Hillary Clinton's aware of the show or anybody Clinton adjacent is aware of the show?
Well, I did the show at one point as a fundraiser for Alessandra Biaggi, who just won her race for state Senate. And she is a former Hillary Clinton employee. So she really enjoyed it. And she said that it really like brought her back as well, but in a way that was made her feel happy. And she is also, I have a friend from college, from Brown, who's one of her speechwriters. So I definitely think it's making its way. It's trickling up to her.
And when are you playing at the Fringe Festival?
So two of our shows are already passed, but we have a show this Wednesday and as well as this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. And then we're going to the Baltimore Fringe Festival, Charm City Fringe, in November.
And then coming back here for midterms, correct? For a
I'm
different
doing,
show.
Yes, I am the special guest at the Bell House midterm election party. It's a bit of an odd choice to have Hillary Clinton, the loser of the last election, be at the party, but I also think that it's a way of us moving forward to have her there.
Have the midterms made you sit down and write as well?
Yeah, I think that's my next show.
Yeah. What do you think you're going to write about?
God, I don't know. I'm still getting through this one. But yeah, I kind of think we have to see what happens. I didn't think I would ever write a musical about Hillary Clinton. That was certainly a surprise. So we'll see what happens in November, and then maybe some new thing will come of it.
And we should also mention that you have had another career, completely different career, as sort of a more formal, not formal, singer-songwriter.
Yes.
Are you going to get back to that at all? Or do you think you're in this vein now? Is this your headspace?
I don't know. I really miss doing that. But I'm having so much fun wearing a pantsuit and swearing stuff I couldn't really do before. So we'll see. But I really did enjoy that. And I did that for a very long time. So it's pretty unlikely that I won't get back to it.
All right. Well, Rebecca Pronsky, thank you so much for coming in the studio to join us. Rebecca Pronsky's piece is Hillary Clinton Song Cycle Witness. It's playing at the New York International Fringe Festival this week, October 17th, 20th, and 21st. She is also playing an election returns party at the Bell House, Brooklyn on midterm night. You have been listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We will be right back after the news.